The BOAG World Show is back, and this season we're going to be answering your questions on people, projects and management. This week we're going to be joined by Sam Barnes, who tackles our first batch of questions. This show is sponsored by Quilla and Envision, so let's begin. Welcome to season 15 of BOAG World. Wow, 15 seasons, Marcus, that's a lot.
We're almost legal.
What? Oh, I see, yeah. Well, if you count the original kind of massive season...
Then we
definitely are.
We're almost of age.
That's good. So, I didn't do my normal introduction, did I? I completely forgot. See, I go away for a few weeks and I forget how to do the podcast.
That's okay.
So, hello all and welcome to BOAGworld.com, the podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running, in particular this season, and running websites on a daily basis. All about, well, I'll tell you in a minute. First of all, let's introduce our guest for this show, Sam Barnes. Hello, sir.
Hello, how are you?
It's really good to have. I don't think you've ever been on the show, have you?
No, I've been listening from, I think, day one, when I sounded like it was in your bedroom, but I'm still here.
Wow. I can't believe, have you really been listening to it that long?
I really have. I remember sending in a question, and I was absolutely stoked it got read out. In hindsight, I'm thinking maybe you got two or three ever at that point.
quite possibly, yeah. Yeah, we got quite desperate at one point. That's the trouble. It's like we're doing that this season. We're the whole season's based on the questions people are sending in, which I'll talk about in a minute. Sure. And there's always this kind of... oh shit, we're just going to end up making up questions, aren't we? So you stand a very good chance of your question getting covered on this show, I have to say.
But you are proof, Sam is proof, that we do actually read out people's questions.
Yeah.
That's, so there you go.
Again, this was when you were in a bedroom, so, you know, just for the context there.
So did you listen to it before Marcus was on the show?
Yes, I did. I think I went back quite a few years back, but went back to listen to some of the early ones, and it was like you alone. You sounded a little depressed after you sounded really sad talking about things, but that's what I listened to on the way to work pretty much most days. It was great. I would, you know, drive to work and actually learn something, so thank you for that.
Well, no, you're more than welcome. So, Sam, I mean, what are you doing these days? What are you up to? Are you? Where is it that you work, talking with your work?
Well, currently, I'm unemployed. So I've been working for the last roughly 5 years for an online dating company as a project manager and also a development team manager, but I've just quit there literally last week, and I'm due to start for M&S Digital on the 31st of May. So that's my answers.
Okay. How exciting. So you're moving to like an agency world.
M&S.
M&S.
So, M&S. No, sorry, I misunderstood.
Not really. So obviously it's the product. I think I'm going to be working around the shop area, but generally just managing people in their digital team. So yeah, very exciting, very exciting. But at the moment I'm unemployed and I'm already getting up late, and you know how it goes.
Paul knows how it goes. Yeah, he never gets up.
I do very little.
He's worked out how to get paid for it, you know? That's what I don't understand.
Yeah. Well, Marcus, you say it. You say it like I should be ashamed of my achievement of working very little.
You've never got up early, Paul. Ever since I've known you. This is not a recent thing. So
no, that's true.
I'm with Paul there, you know. I get to work and people will tell me like the 15 things they've done before they've arrived, and I'm blown away, you know. The world doesn't exist before 7 a.m. for me.
Oh, and the rest.
Yes. So the world is this before 10 a.m. for you, Paul, is it?
No, definitely not. The whole idea of I get quite angry when people arrange morning meetings. And by morning meetings, I mean any time before midday.
Oh, dear.
I'm basically a teenager at heart. Yeah, I think both, you know, that sleeping in forever and all of that kind of thing. And probably intellectually and emotionally as well, but that's a whole other story. So M&S, eh? That yes. sounds very posh.
Very exciting. Well, it's a brand that I've always loved. So I think it'll be the first time I worked for a brand that I genuinely like. So that's already exciting and kind of attracted me to the role in the first place. Yeah. But what I liked about what the digital team are doing is that they seem to be trying to carve out a bit of a new way of working in retail. So very sort of similar to your GDS, but commercially. So I'm quite keen to see, you know, how that pans out. I'm sure it'll be lots of challenges, but I want to give that a go.
So what's your role going to be there?
It's going to be senior development manager, which is essentially line managing about 22 people, I think they told me. Okay. But really, I don't know much more than that. I mean, when I went to speak to them, I was asked what I did at my current role, and I kind of gave the usual summary. But really, it boiled down to sorting stuff out, whatever that stuff may be, you know. I think everyone gets to that kind of stage at some point in their career, the longer they work in digital. And it really, I thought that was a rubbish, you know, explanation of my job. But the response to that was, oh, great, that's just what we need.
That's fantastic, because I haven't put a tagline or a role on my... you know, on my signature on my emails for years, but stuff sorter. I like that.
It could be anything. It's like spotting problems before they happen. It's people problems. It's operational. It really can be anything, you know. I don't really live by any job descriptions these days.
So hang on a minute. I've just completely lost my train of thought. No, that was it. So hang on a minute. Just before this. We started this podcast, we were talking about holidays, and you were saying about how your ideal holiday is to go where people are.
Correct.
And you have said to me on numerous occasions, you don't really like people. It's one of the big things that we have in common.
Absolutely.
And yet you're managing 20 plus people in your new job.
Yes, I've thought about this. I've been asked about this many, many times. And actually, it's an obvious question. It's the same as why do I do speaking when I don't, you know, necessarily find it easy. I think, and I'm not sure, but I think it's because I'm introverted. I think it's because I'm introverted. One of the things that comes with that is sort of a lot of thinking. You know, so a lot of analysis, a lot of introspection and stuff. And I think in a weird kind of way, it's made me sort of analyze people's behavior. I think a lot more about it. I look at things I think a lot of people wouldn't. And it just seems to help me manage people. It also helps that the introversion, sort of understanding what that is, means that I understand everyone's different. And I can sort of see that in people. It is a very odd thing, but it seems to work. You know, it's like I really want to care for those people more than, say, someone who, you know, was maybe a little more extroverted and enjoyed risking and gamble. I think they'll more likely be in sales or something like that.
So you say you don't like people, but you do then. You're actually quite a people person, aren't you?
I do. I mean, I think it's more I don't like being around a load of people, you know, people that I don't particularly like, let's say.
Yeah, it's all right. This podcast will be over soon. You'll get away from us.
This is okay. I can do this in my flat. This is perfect. Thank you. If you asked me to go somewhere, that would have been a different story.
Yeah, perhaps it's the outside you don't like. Perhaps that's the problem.
I do enjoy days when I don't leave the flat. People look at me very strangely, as you're probably thinking now, but I genuinely do enjoy that.
Oh, no, I'm the same. I could easily stay at home forever. You're much more, Marcus, you like kind of meeting people and seeing things and doing things, don't you?
Usually at least 2 days a week I'll work from home completely, just on my own, or the dogs are wandering around, and I have to go to the pub at 6 o'clock. Well, that's what I tell Caroline anyway.
If you'd have said anything but pub, it would have sounded a lot more credible.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's my excuse. It's my little joke.
So actually, having you on the show as somebody that gets stuff done or sorts stuff or whatever it was you said is perfect for this season, because essentially this season is about sorting stuff. It's about all the things that don't fit nicely into any other category. You know, because it's interesting, isn't it? A big percentage of what we do in the digital field isn't actually the things that digital is known for. You know, if you talk about digital, you think of design, you think of development, you maybe think of like usability type of stuff, content maybe. But there's so much more of kind of people and projects and management and politics.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So that's what we're getting into this season.
Excellent.
So we've got some questions for you, Sam, which we're going to do in a few minutes. I'd say for you, really for us, we won't just kind of make you answer them all. So hopefully won't be too bad. But before we do that, I do want to just encourage people to submit questions. We need, as has already been said, we quickly run out of questions on a season like this. So we really need your questions about any aspect of web development that's to do with people or politics or projects or management or that kind of stuff, project management-y type things. And you can submit those by going to boag.world/questions. And you can submit your questions there in the comments at the bottom of the page. And keep those questions coming. I'll collect them together. Alternatively, just email them if you want to at paul@boagworld.com or even tweet them at boagworld. Okay, let's just do a quick sponsor slot before we get into our questions. And I'm really excited to have InVision as a sponsor on this season. Because InVision are one of those kind of well-known staples of design and prototyping and that kind of thing that everybody knows about, except you don't know as much about them as you think. You've probably heard of InVision, but have you actually used their prototyping and design tools? Because they're friggin' amazing. So we're going to talk a lot about different features of InVision over the coming week. But this week I want to talk about just the basics, that you can use InVision to create prototype designs for the web or for mobile, and you can do so amazingly simply. At its most basic level, right, you can take your static design comps that you've produced in Photoshop or Sketch or whatever you've used, and you can upload them to InVision. And then you can use those, you can string them together into a kind of prototype or wireframe. But you could do things like add animations, add gestures if you're dealing with mobile devices. You can add transitions between one state and the other. You can make the whole thing clickable and interactive, basically. So it's a very, very quick way of creating high fidelity prototypes that you can obviously test, which is huge and incredibly useful. And best of all, much of the functionality that they provide absolutely for free, which is mind-blowing. But you could also get three free months, try saying that fast, of unlimited prototyping with the mobile user testing, the boards that they have, which we'll talk about in coming weeks, all of that kind of stuff is all available if you go to boag.world/InVision and then you enter the promo code INV-BOAG, B-O-A-G, and that will give you three free months. But just give them a go anyway, because there's loads that's available for free. And it's a great way of either doing usability testing or also just showing design concepts to stakeholders and clients and people like that. So check them out. Right. So, as we have already said about this season, the premise of the season is to answer your questions about project management, people management, all the other stuff that goes around digital management, let's call it that. And I've been collecting questions from people for a while. I've picked out a few that we're gonna kick the season off with. And the first one is from Mel. She's talking about communication. So her question is, whose job is it to keep communication in a project, I presume she means, flowing? And what can facilitate good or bad communication? And what are good methods for a remote team? So there's kind of three questions all kind of put together into one. So let's start with the job of whose job it is to keep communication flowing.
Everybody's.
Sam. Yeah, that was my immediate reaction as well, Marcus.
I think it kind of depends on how you work, or, you know, maybe who you have working for you. So let's say in an environment where you've got a project manager, you know, sort of a traditional agency, maybe doing a sort of hybrid, but there is a project manager very much running things, it mm-hmm. would, communication would very much fall within their remit to keep it going. Whereas in a Scrum environment, I personally, I think I'd probably get some different answers to this, but I would say it's the Scrum Master's job to coach the team on how to keep communication flowing by sort of leading by example and keeping tabs on it. But I think, you know, really, I mean, one of the things I'm sort of passionate about is not really focusing on this one way of working. So I think regardless of how you're working, at the end of the day, you know, you've really got to appreciate that no matter what we do as a job, that we're first and foremost professionals. You know, we're either building a product or providing a service, and really everyone in that team should see flowing communication as their own responsibility as much as anybody else's. I mean, the truth is that when communication goes wrong, it causes problems for everybody. A lot of people will think that, you know, a project manager having communication issues with a client about something might not affect their work, but at some point it's very likely to. And I think it's my personal approach to it is to kind of obviously lead by example, make sure it's okay, but really try and teach people on the team how to get better at it, and also point out the effects of when it clogs up. I think the
honest answer to that, it's the traditional project manager in a kind of traditional waterfall style project, it's their responsibility to make sure that everybody communicates, but it is actually everyone's job to do it. But if somebody isn't communicating, then they're the ones that need to kind of poke pins in people and make things happen. So yeah, that's my thoughts.
I very much remember years and years back, I saw someone on Twitter say, and this was quite a well-known individual in the web design community, they tweeted something along the lines of, you know, what does my client want from me? I can either build them a website or talk to them, but I can't do both, right? And it was like, oh, no, that's all, you know, because it really is, the communication is so vital. You can't, you know, taking the time to communicate and interact with a client or other stakeholders or even your own team is just as important as the actual work you do, because you can waste so much time building crap that's wrong if you're not communicating regularly.
I think that it goes back to, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but when I started out, I kind of really wanted to be that kind of coder that put his headphones on and just did his work. And really enjoyed that. And I think that you can just go a little bit too far with that. You know, I think we've probably all seen that in our workplaces. And I think it's something to do with experience, but also you just kind of learn along the way that actually the talking is what produces the right result, more so necessarily than the skills, if that makes sense, the actual design or coding skills. You've got to get that talking right.
Yeah, I mean...
And it's weird... Sorry, go on, Marcus.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, I mean... If ever I hear anyone complaining, whether it's at Headscape or elsewhere, it may be because the person that's supposed to be they're working with is doing something wrong. But if only they'd communicated, then things would probably be much better, and the complaining wouldn't be happening.
I mean, it's interesting, mind. There is a little bit of a trend against. Well, there's a very much anti-meetings mentality within our community. And I can see where that comes from to a degree. You know, I hate meetings with a passion. They drive me nuts. But that isn't an excuse for not communicating. And I think sometimes the two get a bit mixed up, don't they? You know?
Very much so.
It's like 37 signals and they're kind of, oh, you know, We don't talk to one another. We sit there and get on with our work. That's actually not what they're saying, is it, really?
I think when it comes to... I did a post on this quite a few years back, and it kind of... It's actually mentioned 37 signals, and it was really about how I think people that have the sort of, dare I say, calibre of people working for them, and it allows them to define different ways of working that are actually easier. So you'll get another company sort of read how they're doing it, and they'll try and implement it, or their team will say, if we're not doing it that way, we're doing it wrong. And I think that there's just this little, it's the same with GitHub and those kind of guys. They get a certain type of person on board, who just knows this stuff. Maybe they've got a lot more experience, but you try and mirror that in sort of company XYZ, and it's not always so easy. And I think there's that little bit in the middle that's always missed about just understanding who you are and who you've got working for you and why that's beneficial to that way of working and why it makes it easier. Certainly,
what's appropriate. Sorry, Paul, carry on.
And there's also alongside that as well is the fact that even if your team are the super efficient, wonderful people that can, you know, can get on with work and speak to each other through telekinetic or telepathic abilities or whatever, that you've still got to interact with clients, you've still got to interact with stakeholders, all of these kinds of people who aren't as aware about what digital can do. So for me, when you talk about keeping communication flowing, it's not just about communicating about the product or project, it's also communication and education go hand in hand.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, so a lot of it is about educating the client, educating stakeholders about why you're doing what you're doing and what your approach is. And to some extent, educating within your own team, you know, so that if you're a developer, educating the designer about what you're doing and why you're doing it and vice versa. So
100%. I mean, this is how I got out of coding. I was working as a really small team. I was a front end developer at the time, but I don't know what it was, something, you know, within me or whatever, but I saw how work was coming into us and how, say, account managers were talking to clients. And I just felt that there was that education lacking on both sides, actually. So you had your production team sort of getting cross with the account managers and vice versa. But it was because neither of them were really explaining the whys. Why are we doing this or anything like that? And it's quite easy to solve. It's a strange thing where you stay in your camps.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say earlier on about this. You know, when people are moaning about the other side, and quite often it's just them failing to communicate or educate, as Paul was saying.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a degree that it's left over from the early days of the web where one person could do it all? You know, 100%. so there wasn't that same need to communicate, perhaps, than there is now.
No, I mean, if I think back to, you know, working with clients 10 years ago compared to now, the conversation with clients then were a lot, comparatively simpler. The technology was simpler, the options were simpler. There was a lot, you know, there wasn't mobile devices. It was much more of a kind of, I want a website, there's a sitemap, go and build it type thing. It's a different world now, very different world.
So what can we, one of the parts of Mel's question is, what can we do to facilitate good communication? What's your tips there?
I think there's a few. So I mean, the very first thing is getting it right from the start. And when I say from the start, I mean possibly even pre-sales, but certainly from the kickoff. You know, it's 101 stuff really, but it's stuff that people do forget to do. So, you know, just clearly defining contact points for a project. You know, if you work for a small agency and you're working with a small client, it's usually okay, but you know, you can work with in a much bigger agency or company, and you could be working with a, you know, global company with you know, 10 stakeholders or whatever. So really nailing down the importance of who the contact points are and, you know, making sure that no one really deviates from that, or at least understanding what the downsides of deviating from that are. So it's really down to certain expectations, you know. I mean, the classic example from older days was when I would be a project manager on a project, and we're working away, everything's great, and then suddenly I see the designer doing something on his screen on my project that I don't quite understand. So I just, you know, ask what he's up to, and it turns out the client's been talking to him. You know, they called them or emailed them, and it's not that you don't want that, but you just want to make sure that you've got a control on it as such. So really just making sure that everyone understands that. I think that obviously having people in the team that can talk, you know, the language of business, technology, design, or at least at a foundation level, that really helps. But that's where the education comes in. I kind of like to not see, you know, developers as the developers and that's all they are. You know, I mean, I think it's a more common now, but certainly even maybe 5 years ago, the thought of educating a developer on some design fundamentals, you know, you might get some screwed up faces at that. But I think that that's so important that you can start to listen to and be involved in conversations outside of your sort of primary area. Mm-hmm. It's really about, I mean, for a project manager, I think a very popular sort of phrase is to be a chameleon. You know, I think that's the ultimate thing, where you can just sort of adapt to any environment. Mm-hmm. Brett Harned, who I think you've got on soon, actually loves something called a racy matrix for communication.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I've used them when you've got that lots and lots of stakeholders tend to be more corporate, but you know, the responsible, accountable, consulted, informed, you know, it can work really well. I mean, people do go outside it, but at least you've laid down some sort of rules of engagement to begin with. And I think finally, one of the things that I find just helps, regardless again of how you work, is something actually I've sort of stolen from Scrum, which is something that I was taught about Scrum was that one of the things is to get into the rhythm of your ceremonies, you know, your stand-ups, your sprint planning, your retrospectives. But I think the same with regular communication. You know, if you get into just a regular status update, whatever it might be, it doesn't really matter how you're doing it, but just something that everyone knows is going to happen at this time and in what format and what to bring. I think it just all kind of fits into place when everyone knows it will always happen then.
That's, that last one is quite an interesting one, because I actually think sometimes you get into a scenario, and I've with some of the people that I've mentored before, where they've talked about, oh, this project is really, you know, it's been really problematic, and we scheduled the work in for August, and in July they were hassling me about, you know, what was going on, and well, we haven't done it yet, you know, and then they got more and more. But I actually encourage people, look, communicate, even if you've got nothing to say. You know, even if all you're saying is, well, we've got this work scheduled in for August, you know, just say that.
Well, one of the most simple solutions I've ever found to this is a weekly status report. Now, that sounds obvious on the face of it, but what I found when I started using these was that, you know, it doesn't have to, first thing is, people send status reports, they're too big, they're paragraphs rather than bullet points, whatever it might be. They need to be really easily digestible by whoever's reading them. You have to send it on the same day, ideally at the same time, and in the right and in the same format. And it doesn't need to, it just has to, like, what we've achieved this week, what we're going to do next week, any blockers, what's the current budget, and what's the current timeline. Just those points. And again, you don't have to have made any significant progress or there've been any problem, but you still send it. And I think the problem is that you get a project, you win it, and then you get to week one. You know, only a week ago, you probably signed some paperwork, and nothing's changed, unless something's gone really badly. But usually, nothing's changed. So you, even as a project manager, even when you know it's the right thing to do, it does cross your mind that, is it worth sending it on week one? Yeah. You know, it just seems a bit dogmatic. But I've learned the hard way, to be honest, that if you do that from day one, it's like an involving set of news for the client. And it not only keeps the communication going, flowing really well, but also it's a really early trigger point to have potentially difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. As for keeping your team up to date, I personally like to send those reports to the company, to my own team. It has so many sort of advantages, you know, from just keeping people up to date, but also, it sounds silly, but when you are a developer or designer or someone that enjoys working in isolation, that's fine. But at the end of the day, any sort of issues on your side will have an effect. Mm-hmm. Often I found that people who maybe have made a mistake, as we all do, they won't really appreciate, you know, what that means for the project, for the bigger world as such. But if they get this report, as with everyone else, that shows mistakes and problems and how it affects budget and timeline, it kind of crystallizes it as more of a business than just this thing you do over there. But you're not doing it in a kind of patronizing way. Everyone's getting the same. It's just what it is. It just changes how you view, you know, your job, I think.
Yeah, I like that a lot. That's really good. I tell you another thing that you said is you said about, you know, it should start early. And then you vaguely mentioned that even the kind of sales process.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important thing. It's right from the very beginning. It's very tempting when you're in that beginning sales point to tell the client what they want to hear.
Yeah.
But actually, that's the time when you should start challenging them. You should start kind of being really honest and upfront about their expectations. Absolutely, whether they're and I've got to say, I mean, Marcus, from our experience, that's nothing but beneficial, is it really? I mean, clients warm to that honesty.
Generally speaking, yeah. I mean, normally the kind of people who don't like hearing the truth, you don't want to work with. But, yeah, I mean, that we were talking about, you know, how things have changed over the years. I think one of the reasons why communication between kind of creative departments and coding departments and sales have often been difficult is because of what we're talking about now. And you can understand why a salesman who has a target is thinking, well, if I can promise a bit more here, I'm going to win this work, and that means I'm going to win my target, that he promises it. So the answer here is make sure you involve people from the creative team in the sales process.
Sorry, Mark.
That's all right, carry on.
Well, I was just going to say that I've had that so often in the past, but what I did find was that the people that were being affected by bad sales actually didn't want to go that extra step, because I would always advise, and I did to myself, you get involved in the pre-sales, just go along, you know, start to understand the pressures of sales, of cash flow, of things that are nowhere near your world at that time. But once you understand about targets, you start to see why they might be bending the truth. But there's other ways to do it. You know, you can still have a successful sales meeting without necessarily that, and they can pass over to you, and before you know it, you're a salesman as well, but you're hopefully selling in a sort of more ethical way that's going to result in a better result.
I can guarantee that any salesperson would want that person in the room with them
100%,
every single time, because the last thing you want to do is be coming over as, maybe, oh, I don't really know what I'm talking about here. Obviously, we know now to sort of like say, look, I'll come back to you on that. But maybe back in those early Wild West days, I'll just make it up and say, yeah, we can do that, you know.
We stopped doing that.
We stopped doing that. Probably end of last year sometime, Paul.
Nobody sent me the memo.
Sorry, you're still making it up. Fair enough.
Yeah. The last part of Mel's question was about managing remote teams. Is that something you've ever had to do, Sam?
Not sort of in line management capacity, but certainly in a project management capacity. I've got a lot to say on this. I mean, there's so much you can read already out there. I mean, the first thing that has to be said whenever I talk about this is that there really is no substitute for being with someone. I think, it's, you know, as much as I say it, people do start to think that it doesn't make a difference. And while that's the sort of dream, I think at the moment it really does make a difference. But when I've had to do it, I've tried so many techniques, like, you know, obviously there's chat programs like Slack, which everyone's pretty much using now. I've even tried a tool, I think it's actually shutting down now, but it's an interesting idea. It was called Squiggle. So it was Squiggle.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it felt a bit creepy. Don't think they'd sort of finished it. You know, you didn't really get any privacy, but I quite like the sort of premise. I quite like the idea that I kind of see that's where we might be in sort of 5-10 years, some kind of always on with privacy to pick your nose or whatever you need to do. You know, I think that the main thing for now, or what I've experienced certainly with remote teams, is, you know, everything's got to be documented. It's very different to managing a team you're with. Everything has to be documented. There needs to be centralized to-do lists. So really, everyone can see the status of work, because obviously with remote working comes different time zones and all sorts of complications like that. I think also that there needs to be a willingness, ideally, to sort of spend on making working remote teams easier. So my last company, we built a very tiny little glass room, but we called it the Skype room. But it's where we used what we used for stand-ups and retrospectives. And the idea was that it was as seamless as possible. Mm. I think, Natalie Semchuk is a remote project manager based in New York, and she's like done lots and lots of talking on this, so she's got so many good points, like being extra clear when communicating, and, you know, little things like repeating instructions back to people over medium. It's funny how, you know, you need to understand that it's correct. Another thing she talks about is how it's really harder to spot if people are going off on a tangent. I think you mentioned that earlier, Marcus, that people don't sort of own up as quickly remotely. You know, they'll try and work it out, and you only find out later in the process, and that's just an awful lot of pain. Little things like asking how each person prefers to communicate when they're remote. So, that's something I like to do, and even asking whether it's morning or evening, when do they prefer to have this chat, and how do they prefer to talk, rather than in sort of making everybody do the same thing. Some people are really uncomfortable talking on audio or video. I don't know why. Some of them prefer chat or whatever. But I think one of the things that actually really helps with working with a remote team, not so much in the communication, but is actually getting to know your remote teammates. I know Natalie talks about this as well. It's something I've experienced, that when you're remote, you kind of lose that silly interaction you have in the office, you know? They mess around. What do they do at the weekend? I think you've got to try and sort of make a conscious effort to, you know, ask them how their day was, and not talk about work, and you get that bond that you get. I think the main thing about working remote teams is that when you start doing it, you're always going to encounter some issues, and it could be technical, it could be operational. There's so many different little things that will happen, but the key thing is to push through those and actually see those as things to solve rather than reasons to pull back from remote. It's quite hard to do at times, but I think it's really I've seen it really work in the past. So yeah,
I mean, for me, I think the biggest barrier to remote teams is actually psychological. It's trust.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, that you have to be able to trust the people within your team, and that takes a very different management mindset. You know, I think there's still a lot of organizations that manage with this kind of command and control structure. And the truth is that when you've got remote teams, you have to trust people to do their job and to get on with it and to do what needs to be done. And it's moving away from the mentality of hours of work done to result driven stuff. That I think makes a big difference.
Yeah,
I think we can learn a lot from how we work with clients as well. So how we work with clients, we can take that to how we work internally, because clients are all remote pretty much. It's very rare you get one over the road. I found with certain clients where we have an hour's call, which is usually video call, where we ensure a proper agenda and we take proper notes and everything is, you were saying earlier, you go over everything twice, make sure we understood everything. They are the projects that go really well. What we'd like to do with more kind of the more technical projects is get the client in with probably about a month to go and sit round the table just banging through all those little issues that we need to do. That might not have been part of the original the original spec for the project, but it's just worth it because it's that idea of getting people face to face. So if just those two things, if you have at least a weekly, sure, with an internal team it would probably be more often than that, but at least a weekly face to face, i.e. with video call, where you have a proper agenda that you go through, etc., etc., along with, I don't know how often, but however often is appropriate, around the table face to face, they're worth their weight in gold, both of those things. That's my bit.
Do you think it affects who you can hire if you're working remotely? Because my feeling is it's quite hard to manage a very junior member of staff remotely.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. It's trust, but that's a different kind of lack of trust. It's not lack of trust in their character or their ability to stay focused. It's their ability to work, I guess, unguided. When I started, I needed someone next to me all the time. You know, there'd be a million little questions throughout the day. So definitely affects that. I think it's something we're going to have to conquer.
That's the way
we're going. So
it is, without doubt. And I think it's good for many, many reasons. But it does create some challenges too. Well, do you know what we've been talking for ages, and in theory we've only done one question.
Let's do another one.
How many have you got? Have you only got two questions? Is that the problem here?
Admittedly, Mel managed to get three questions rolled into one. So good for Mel. Next up is a question from Brian. So his question is, how do you balance cool new technologies, libraries, tools, etc., with the old tried, tested and true methods?
Oh, yes.
Which I think is a good one, because you get teams of designers and developers that are always wanting to do the new cool funky thing. But with that comes risk. Yeah. So how do you manage that risk?
Well, I mean, I think I wrote a post about this for Think Vitamin like in 2011 or something, when HTML5 was first kind of bursting onto the scene and everyone was just trying to build every new site in it. I saw a really similar post, a really, really good post actually, by Dan McKinley. He's formerly of Stripe and Etsy. And the post is called Choose Boring Technology, which I thought was a great title. But really, his thoughts are exactly the same as mine. I think it comes with that experience. So in the post, he mentions that Etsy, he actually spent 7 years there. So he was actually able to see the full ramifications of decisions made, you know, in this dilemma as such. And one of the things he was saying was that, you know, the good thing about boring technology, I mean, if you want to call boring tried and tested, is that it's not just the capabilities that are known of that, but it's also how they fail and where they fail. Mm. You know, and that he said that technology choices don't happen in isolation. You know, so adding a new technology comes at a cost to your company. Mm. So really, it is a really tricky balance to get right. But what he tries to get across is that, you know, your job is keeping the company in business. That's your job. Irrelevant of what you do, your job is to keep the business going, and therefore you have to sort of start with that as your decision basis for are you going to use new tech or not. And I think it's written down here. He says a good question to ask whenever you're considering whether you should use the funky new tech or not is basically he'd actually ask everyone, how would you solve your immediate problem without adding anything new?
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. If you start to go off that premise, then you start to think, well, we could do this, we could do this and that. The truth is that I think it's a decision each time. It is based on risk. It's based on your business. You have to at least accept that, you know, especially if you're working as part of a larger team. I've worked as part of a team where we chose to use Angular for a certain feature, and it was great. It was working great. It was almost like it was built for it. What we didn't really appreciate at the time, and I think what Dan's trying to get across, is what that meant. So the people that were skilled in Angular or in any new tech, if they leave, where does that leave?
Yeah.
What dependencies, yeah. You know, is this thing secure? How quickly can it become insecure? This is it performant, and will it work on our stack? There's so many questions. So I think, you know, I would just go back to Dan's post where he's asking everyone to think, just take a step back, really, rather than get excited, which is very easy to do. Just take a step back and work out what's best for the client and the business before you even consider what tech to use.
There is not a flip side. There is another consideration there, Mike. I totally, utterly agree with everything you said, by the way. But there's also that element where, you know, you're responsible for a team of 20 people and their career advancement, their happiness in their job. Marcus is responsible for an agency of people that, and he's trying to retain staff and keep them engaged. You know.
No, I understand.
You see what I'm getting at there?
I think, in the past, you have to, again, it's all that balance. If you need to start using some stuff, you know, that people want to use, it's exciting, and who knows, it could be the next standard. Yes, you have to consider that with team morale, especially if company down the road is offering people to use that, you know, anytime they want. I think that you have to be mindful of both, and you have to be sort of wise about where you try out the new technology, you know? Mm. So good examples are internal projects or very small projects or just the things that have just enough or not enough risk that if it doesn't work, it's not going to be a disaster for your company, you know. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very measured in both approaches.
They're both, you know, the idea of not of holding back a technology that everybody wants to use is probably going to affect the business, so it's still a business related decision.
True.
Because there's also a danger that you get stuck in a rut and you never move forward. And next thing you know, you're still building in ColdFusion, you know, or you're still building Flash. Yeah. So it's a really tricky one, this one.
I think you can make sort of get the company understanding it if you approach it as, so let's say when we were going to use Angular, that only affected, say, some of the sort of front end JavaScript developers. But, you know, the fact of the matter is everyone's going to have to interact with this. From operations right through to, you know, back-end devs, whoever it might be. And I think if you actually involve them in the decision, and as a team you agree, we're going to go for this. And as a team you take on that risk as such, that's kind of, it feels more, because when we did it, it was like that. We didn't do it that way. So when some issues arose because of what we chosen to use, it was really tricky to deal with, because it was really down to one or two people in a team of 40, you know? Mm.
And that, you're right, you're really right about the risk of that knowledge going away, going to another company or whatever else, which is always really a worrying scenario that
definitely
keeps me awake.
Paul, though, and I've got to, we can't move on from this one yet, Paul, because you basically recommend something new on a weekly basis.
Yeah, I do.
And we learn to ignore you.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's the really interesting thing, isn't it, about the dynamic that we used to have in Headscape, was that, you know, you need people like me that push and push and push and push and push, right? You know, always trying new things, always exploring the edge of what's out there. But you need equally people like Sam or Chris, in our case, you know, to constantly say, yeah, but let's think that through. Let's think through the details. And I was fully comfortable, and I, you know, with the fact that you would reject 80% of what I said. And, you know, I kind of accept that that's the reality of doing business. And I think maybe that's the problem that some people, the frustration some people have within the company, is if you are that pushy person, if you are the person like me that's always playing with a new toy, you need to accept that only a small fraction of those are ever going to make it to be in production, you know, and integrated into the process. And presuming that you can accept that, then there's nothing wrong with you continually suggesting ideas. The problem comes is where it turns into a conflict point between the sensible people like Sam, who are, you know, are wanting to do, you know, the right boring thing, and then the people like us that are, you know, want to do the wrong exciting thing. And it's just understanding each other's perspective.
Well, I think that's so important. Finding that balance between you two working, or those two types of people working, is where I think you get either a successful company with a happy team, or actually that horrible, toxic environment where no one gets on and you don't really produce good work. It's taken me a long time to sort of learn that. I think when I'm as guilty as anybody. When I was just a front-end developer, that's all I did. I wanted to use the latest everything, and I couldn't understand at that point in my career why there was so much resistance. It did just feel like, you know, people being dogmatic, or people being nervous, or not up to date. Of course, looking back, I realize now, and I think that's what our job is now, the people that sort stuff out. It's our job to look out for that kind of thing as much as anything else business related, and try and explain these things to people how I wish I would have had it explained to me at that point in my career.
Yeah, and it is so important not to just say no, you know, not to dismiss people, because that's, you know, I remember when I was younger and like this, but, you know, there was a very specific turning point in Headscape for me, which I'll talk about in a minute, but there was the pre that point where I just felt continually dismissed, that I was coming up with these great ideas. I was trying to push the company forward, and Chris was being a miserable shit the whole time. You know, that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
I'm exaggerating for comic effect. But, you know, but that was because Chris maybe wasn't articulating as well as he could be as to why it wasn't a bad idea. He was just sucking his, you know breath in through his teeth and going, yeah. So explaining it is so important, you know, what the risks are. And one of the things that I quite like to do is instead of just dismissing something and saying, I do this with clients quite a lot, you know, when clients come up with some dumbass idea, instead of just saying, no, that's a stupid idea, or even explaining why it's wrong, I'll start to ask questions. Well, you know, and you could do the same with people that come wanting new technologies. Okay, so how are we going to deal with the legacy here? What happens when you leave? You know, get them to think it through themselves.
Sure.
In terms of the turning point with the different character types, it was when we worked with, what were they called, Marcus? The people that wrote reports on your personality.
Oh, Insights. Still working for them.
Bloody amazing that was. So these guys, this is a total tangent really, and I don't think we're going to get onto our third question, which is funny, but it really interesting, because it shows quite an interesting part of this dealing with stuff element, which is the people. So we work with a company called Insights, and Insights basically a bit like Myers-Briggs, they write reports on people and their personality, they insisted pretty much, didn't they, that those of us that were involved in the project completed these 20 odd questions so that they could assess us and that we could understand what it was that they did better.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so we did. We literally just filled in. It was only 20 questions.
It's 25 questions, but I can remember.
25.
I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to. But I can remember what somebody, they might have been joking, he says, to cover himself. It actually only takes 10 questions, but if you only do 10, people don't believe the results. So they have to ask 25.
So they asked these 25 questions. And I'll tell you, the report that I got back was the most enlightening thing I've ever read about myself. And suddenly it just, and of course I saw what Chris's was as well, and Marcus's, although I'm nearer Marcus than I am Chris, which is why I pick on Chris a lot.
You and I, we're only one segment apart, I think, Paul.
Yeah, we were quite close. Well, yeah. me and Chris are basically opposites. But it helped me to understand him, and it helped me to understand me, and it just made me realise that actually it's not other people being dicks when they say no to me, but it is just a different view of the world. And it was a really, really enlightening process. I'm really glad I did it.
I think another thing that I learned last year, I think, was empathy maps. So I'd never come across these. So I, as you said, I'm in people management. I kind of tend to find it easier than others to empathize. But when we were presented with this in a workshop, we went through this and I actually pictured someone in my head that I felt was always, you know, saying no. And, you know, so it sounds like how you thought about Chris at the time. And I admit, I thought, I'm not going to learn anything new from doing this. But wow, you know, I really, really, really did. Just going through the exercise for 15 minutes. If I'd have known that 10 years ago, it would have saved me an awful lot of pain with lots of people, I think.
Well, that's Insights' business, though. That revelationary feeling is that we all feel it when we do these exercises, and they've got a global business out of it because they know that's what they've got. It really does help.
It's witchcraft, is what it is.
It is.
But I'll tell you what's really interesting about you mentioning empathy maps is, you know, as a user experience designer, I use empathy maps all the time with users. And I say this all the time to other designers. Look, we're so good at, you know, using, you know, empathizing with our end users, but we don't apply that same knowledge to the colleagues, the people that we work with every day. And we so need to. It's so important.
Well, I think, again, coming back to the introversion, extroversion, many years ago, I would sort of have, say, conflict to a little bit with, say, some bosses who were doing the selling. And I was a project manager. And we would constantly, I would be the one, like you said earlier, I'd be the one sort of pulling back. And this person would be, you know, selling or taking gambles. And at the time, it just seemed like the craziness to me, but also for him too. And it's taken me, again, a long time to realise, actually, it was just different types of people. So me telling him to, you know, not go out selling and not go out gambling and not just put a number out of the air, me saying not to do that was actually killing what he found fun about work. And likewise, when he wanted me to take all these risks, it was doing the same. And I think just that understanding of the difference in people can actually change everything pretty much overnight. But two parties understand.
Yeah, and interestingly, that brings us full circle, doesn't it? You know, the two questions that we've had. The first one was about communication. The first one was about balancing new technologies with old one. And actually, the answer to the second question from Brian about balancing technologies, etc., is about the first one. It's about good communication. It's about talking these things through as a team. I think that might be a reoccurring theme of this season. The answer to whatever the question is good communication.
Absolutely.
And I think at that point we'll wrap it up. We did have another question, but you'll just have to come back, Sam, and talk about this again.
Cliffhanger for them. Nice one. It's not that exciting.
The worst cliffhanger in the world. It'd be even better. I know. I'm going to read what the question is, and that would be a cliffhanger.
Oh, you can't.
The question. Is that too much?
No, do it. Go on, do it.
Okay. What are effective teams doing to ensure that everyone has access to the company-wide information and resources? Well, that's easier. That's from Prescott. The answer is communicate.
Exactly.
It's like when I was a kid and I used to go to Sunday school. Didn't matter what the question was. The answer was always Jesus. It's easy. So there you go. Right. Okay. So we're going to pick up Prescott's question maybe next week or at some point when Sam comes back, or we'll definitely get around to it. So don't worry, Prescott. I haven't forgotten you. Okay, let's quickly do our other sponsor before we wrap up this week's show. And it's a great sponsor to have for all this talk about, you know, non-design development stuff. It's a product called Quilla. Now, last season, I talked about, various seasons before, I've talked about different proposal writing software.
But I didn't know whether to bring this up, Paul, or not.
Well, I'm not going to mention the name of the other one that we've done, right? Okay. And it's really good, the other bit of software that we've used. But since the end of last season, I've actually discovered this new and really impressive piece of proposal writing software that now has become my go-to bit of software. So going back to what we've just been saying about me flipping from one thing to another at a drop of a hat, classic example of it here. But this is so sexy, you see? Yeah. And I need it. And it's shiny. New and shiny. Yeah, and it really is. It's called Quillr, which is Q-W-I-L-R. So the name needs some work. And it just produces gorgeous looking proposals, right? It's, you know, it's really, you can have, and not only is it gorgeous looking proposals, but effectively they're these kind of mini websites that you can include video in, you can include iframes in, they're rich and interactive, and oh, it's just sex on a stick, it really is. I shouldn't get this excited about a proposal writing software, but I really do. It's so easy to put proposals together that look absolutely stunning and will blow your clients away. I'm going to talk a bit more next week about some of the details of what they do, but just the ease of use is great. You know, that you can create this great looking website very easily. You've got this kind of reusable blocks of content, so you can use it from one project to another, and that you can also save it out as a PDF for those clients that like something printed. So definitely check it out. Really, really good piece of software. I'll tell you a bit more about it next week, but it's worth having to play with. They've got a free trial, and also you can get 50% off for 3 months if you use the promo code BOAG, B-O-A-G. Find out more about them and to use that promo or to get the free trial, go to boag.world/proposal. I won't make you spell Quillr. So for boag.world/proposal. All right, so that pretty much wraps it up. Marcus, new season of jokes.
I know, and thank you to Nick Johnson-Hill on the BOAG World Slack channel. It's given me loads.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, first one of the season, I think it's rather good. A Roman walks into a bar and holds up two fingers and says, 5 beers, please.
That is terrible. I don't even know if that qualifies as a joke, does it?
I thought it was quite good. It's probably maybe one of... All right, I'll give you another one.
All right.
I removed the shell from my racing snail to make him go faster, but if anything, it made him more sluggish.
Oh, no, that's terrible.
Oh, well, I like those two a lot. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Nick. Much appreciated. Just a reminder to send us in your questions. You could do that at boag.world/questions. Next week, as Sam has just said earlier on in the show, we've got Brett Honnard joining us, and he's going to tackle a few more questions. And no doubt, Sam, will you come back later in the season? Give us
sure, yeah.
Go. Yes, wonderful stuff. No, put you on the spot in the middle of the...
Yeah, that's a no, yes. Really. Pete. That's a no, polite
no. No, he said it. He said it. We've got it in recording. He has to now. So thank you so much for joining us, Sam. And for everybody else, see you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.